This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Lovely Bones, the new Peter Jackson movie based on the novel by Alice Siebold, comes out today. Our film critic, David Edelstein, will review the movie later in the show. But we'd like to start out by replaying Terry's 2002 interview with the author herself. When Alice Siebold's The Lovely Bones was published 7 years ago, Time magazine called it the breakout fiction debut of the year. The story is about the rape, murder, and mutilation of a 14-year-old girl. Our own book critic, Maureen Corrigan, said the subject matter made her reluctant to pick up the book, but reading it gave her a singular, disturbing, and even enlightening literary experience. Alice Siebold was herself the victim of a violent sexual assault. She was raped during her first year in college. Her 1999 memoir about that experience is called Lucky. Siebold's novel, The Lovely Bones, begins with the attack on the girl. The rest of the novel is narrated from heaven, where the girl observes her family and friends as they try to carry on after her death. We'll start with a reading from the beginning of the book. The girl has taken a shortcut home from junior high through a cornfield. She meets a neighbor, Mr. Harvey, who forces her to take off her clothes. Before we start, I should let you know that what you're about to hear is graphic and disturbing. It may be upsetting to some listeners and may not be appropriate for children to hear.
"Don't, Mr. Harvey," I managed, and I kept saying that one word a lot, "don't," and I said "please" a lot, too. Franny told me that almost everyone begged "please" before dying. "I want you, Susie," he said. "Please," I said. "Don't," I said. Sometimes I combined them, "please don't," or "don't please." It was like insisting that a key works when it doesn't, or yelling, "I've got it, I've got it, I've got it," as a softball goes sailing over you into the stands. "Please don't." But he grew tired of hearing me plead. He reached into the pocket of my parka and balled up the hat my mother had made me, smashing it into my mouth. The only sound I made after that was the weak tinkling of bells. As he kissed his wet lips down my face and neck and then began to shove his hands up under my shirt, I wept. I began to leave my body. I began to inhabit the air and the silence. I wept and struggled so I would not feel. He ripped open my pants, not having found the invisible zipper my mother had artfully sewn into their side. "Big white panties," he said. I felt huge and bloated. I felt like a sea in which he stood and pissed and I felt the corners of my body were turning in on themselves and out, like in Cat's Cradle, which I played with Lindsay just to make her happy. He started working himself over me. "Susie, Susie," I heard my mother calling. "Dinner is ready." He was inside me. He was grunting. "We're having string beans and lamb." I was the mortar. He was the pestle. "Your brother has a new finger painting, and I made apple crumb cake."
That's Alice Siebold reading from the opening of her new novel, The Lovely Bones. I'm sure a lot of listeners are wondering why write about something so horrible, so unthinkable, the rape and dismemberment of a 14-year-old girl.
Because it's part of life. You know, that's the simplest answer, I think, for me. It's very much part of the experience of what it is to live in this culture. It happens all the time.
Now, you were raped yourself when you were a freshman in college, and that's a subject of an earlier book you wrote, a memoir. And reading those two books back to back, I was really struck by the difference in the descriptions of the rape. The rape, as you describe it in your memoir, is very brutal, very detailed in its brutality. It's as if you're reliving every moment and describing it like a journalist.
Mm-hmm. I think they are very different books in my mind, even though they both not only have violence but start out in violence. One of them is factual, and I tell every detail in some way in the memoir, and the other one is a fictive voice, and there's so much more being given in the first chapter of The Lovely Bones in terms of getting to know her character and some of the facts of her family and her background.
I got the impression that the kind of moment-by-moment description of the brutality that's in your memoir is something you felt didn't belong in this new novel, in the description of the brutality that this 14-year-old faces.
Yeah, funny thing is that I did write the beginning of The Lovely Bones before I wrote my memoir. So Susie's, the violent crime that occurs in Susie's life happened in terms of writing about it before a description of my own rape was written by me later. I think in order to separate the two stories to make sure that Susie was not doing any of my work for me when I returned to the novel, I stopped to write Lucky. And one of the things that it was very important for me to do was to get all the facts down of my own case. So they had been written, they existed whole in a whole nother book, and I could go back to Susie and she could lead me where she wanted to take me and tell me her story in the way she wanted to tell it, as opposed to me feeling perhaps that I needed to really tell the real deal about every detail about rape and violence. I did that in the memoir as opposed to the novel. Because I wanted my characters to rule the novel, not some sort of desire to talk about rape and reveal rape to readers.
Your memoir ends, "I live in a world where the two truths coexist, where both hell and hope live in the palm of my hand." Is that in a way where your novel picks up with hell and hope or hell and heaven being side by side?
Definitely. I mean, that's one of my major motivations in terms of how I live my life. And also, though, why I see fiction as so incredibly important is to be able to give, in a very short space, the context for those two things coexisting and coexisting in an honest way, where hope is really springing out of something that was is hard won, as opposed to purchased in the, you know, how to cope section at the local bookstore.
After Susie is raped and killed and mutilated, and this is in the first chapter, she goes to heaven, and the rest of the story is narrated by her as she experiences this part of heaven and looks down on her family and neighbors as they go on without her. What interested you in this idea of your narrator being in heaven looking down on the people she's had to leave behind?
I think I needed to find a way, and first I have to say that, again, when Susie's voice presented it to me, she presented completely, and she was already in heaven. So that was something when I got to the end of the first 15 pages, which I did not know was going to be the first chapter of a novel. I had my character, I had where she was, and I had what had happened to her. And because she was such a bossy main character, I had no choice. I had to follow her. So, though it was not conscious, a choice to place her in heaven, once I realized that she had put me there in some way, it is a position from which she can tell a story to a reader and bring a reader to places that they wouldn't have access on and that she wouldn't have access on unless she were in heaven. And to see, referring back to the previous question about heaven and hope or hope and hell, all those things, to see those things put together in a context that is ultimately in some way horrible but doesn't have to be so threatening that readers are afraid to read about the truth or about the reality that a girl like Susie would experience.
In your memoir about being raped, you write, "The burden of being father and mother to a rape victim fell very heavily on my parents." And I'm wondering if that thought informs some of the writing of your novel, because part of the novel is about the after effects of the rape and murder on Susie's family.
Definitely. The experience of violence, particularly a tabooed violence, like a rape in my case, and particularly like a rape and dismemberment in the case of Susie's family in the novel, is one of the most alienating experiences that I think you can have. And for my parents, it proved to be very strange sometimes, even among their close friends, even with people who didn't intentionally mean to say things that were hurtful, for instance, and sometimes hurtful through ignorance, which is not necessarily their fault. And I think definitely that that transferred to the idea of Susie's family being extremely alienated in their circumstances.
You write about the burden of guilt on the parents in the novel. Susie says about her father, every day he got up, before sleep wore off, he was who he used to be. Then as his consciousness woke, it was as if poison seeped in. At first he couldn't even get up. He lay there under a heavy weight, the guilt on him, the hand of God pressing down on him, saying, you were not there when your daughter needed you. Do you want to talk a little bit about the guilt you imagine the parents feeling?
It's an interesting thing. Some of the father was another character for me in the novel that was there very quickly, very immediately, and he really, to me, is the heart of the family. I think particularly with a sexual assault crime, whether the victim, if the victim is a child, whether it's a male or a female child, fathers often feel extremely responsible for what happens in that way to their children. They want to be able to fix it very, very much and go out and do something. And it has become somewhat stereotypical in movies and television that the father wants to go and catch or kill the perpetrator. But the truth is that it's a stereotype that reflects reality. In my own experience, I can count the number of times that, both my father but also boyfriends, male friends, particularly would say things like, you know, I want to kill the bastard. Just in this desire to do something, and also to great shame because the perpetrator is male.
After you were raped, when you were trying to figure out what you were doing with your life and dealing with all the wounds that this rape left you with, psychological and physical, were you at the same time watching your parents dealing with a different set of wounds caused by the same rape?
Definitely, particularly my mother, I think. You know, it just hits the entire family like a ton of bricks. And trauma is, especially when it's a trauma that is not a well-known trauma for those traumas that are well-known, really, there's so much to try to understand. I remember watching television, say, with my sister after the rape when I was just basically lying on the couch and trying to recover. And if anything came on that made her maybe think about violence or whatever, she would stare back at me, and it made me highly self-conscious. But she was deeply trying to understand what my experience had been. And I think one of my motivations for writing my own book, and certainly also a motivation for writing the novel, is the desire to just put it out there on the table. This is what a rape can look like. And if people maybe know more about it, then the victim's not as alienated, nor is the victim's family. And nor are people who live across the street as afraid of saying something really stupid, because maybe they're more educated about what the crime is.
Now, you said earlier that it was only after writing the beginning of your novel, The Lovely Bones, that you decided to go back and write a memoir about your rape. And you said it was because you wanted to, like, tell your own story so that your own story wasn't superimposed on your character's story. I'm interested in how your memory functioned of mm-hmm. the incident, because, you know, when after something that's about as traumatic as it gets happens to you, on the one hand, you really want to forget it so that it's not obsessing you and haunting you all the time. On the other hand, I suppose in a lot of ways you don't want to lose the memories that have been recorded so that you can continue to comprehend the experience. So did you find that you had, like, vivid memories of it, vivid enough to write an almost journalistic account of it? Or did you have to work to regain memories that you had tried to forget?
I would say my memory for the rape itself and the incidents surrounding the rape, like the trial, was better 5 to 7 years after the actual event, even up to 10, than it was in the first 3 or 4 years afterwards. You know, I very directly went into therapy right after the rape, all miserable experiences. And then I didn't do anything like that for about the next 10 years. And I found a lovely therapist who had the, you know, uniqueness of being free in New York and worked with her. But only after, I'd say, a full 10 years away from the rape was I able to face the rape and deal with the clear memories of it. Luckily, one of the things I did right after the rape, because I was a kind of a, you know, morbid poetic kid, was write verbatim accounts of exactly what had happened to me physically and what the light had been like and things like that in a journal of mine.
You were already interested in writing when you were raped. You were a freshman in college. Later in college, you were studying with the poet Tess Gallagher.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the assignments she gave you after she realized about this trauma in your life was to write a poem that started, "If They Caught You."
Right.
I could see you responding one of two ways to that. One way to go, "Oh, give me a break," and the other to actually write a great poem. tell us what your response was to that.
I think with Tess, who was one of those teachers, I mean, I have taught and I have had wonderful teachers, and I believe that atmosphere, particularly for those students who are going through anything traumatic, can be an incredible atmosphere. And Tess did not shy away from dealing with a student who I'm sure a lot of people just thought, like, eek, keep her away from me. She might explode on me. She forced my hand on that. I had written a vague kind of poem about rape. We had a discussion in her office. She asked me if it were based on anything that had actually happened to me in my life. I told her, and then she suggested that. I admired her greatly as a poet. She was an extremely empathetic teacher. And out of that, I decided, okay, she's forcing me to do something. It feels a little weird, but it was a great thing to do. So, and they caught him a week later. So who knows? There was a little magic in that assignment.
People often wonder if writing is therapeutic. If you're writing about a trauma, does that help the pain of the trauma recede? I mean, Susie in the novel says something about, I forget exactly what she says, but it's something like every time she tells her story, like a drop of the pain goes away.
Right.
But as a writer yourself who's written about your own trauma and then written a mm-hmm. fictionalized version of a similar trauma, is writing therapeutic or do you think that that's really the wrong way to approach it anyways?
My feeling, and it's pretty, you know, rigorous, is that therapy is for therapy, and that writing can be therapeutic, but therapeutic writing should not be published. My job as a writer is to go through the therapy myself, and if I manage to get through it and I feel I have something to share from that, to share it with my audience or my readers, but I don't write novels and seek to have them published so that I can get therapy from having written them. That's really the responsibility of an individual to do outside the context of their published work.
Writers usually have to have some kind of empathy and understanding of each of their characters, the good guys and the bad guys. Do you feel like in your novel you had to have empathy for the rapist, who's a man from the neighborhood? He's a man that the family knows.
Definitely. I mean, in my own personal belief, you can't write a good character unless you have both compassion and respect for them. So Mr. Harvey, who is the killer in the book, yes, I have great compassion for him. There are moments where he attempts to try to do things other than what his driver's instinct is telling him to do, by counting things obsessively or building things. So he resists up until the point where he's no longer able to resist. And, you know, that is, you can have compassion without forgiveness. And I think that's what I would say.
Were you able to find that kind of compassion for the man who raped you?
I would say eventually, certainly not immediately. But, you know, we're all born into this world in very different ways, and we have different experiences of it. And I don't know a lot about him, but some of the things I do know led me to feel compassion for him. There are also many people who had much more worse circumstances than he did that have managed not to go out and rape people. But that doesn't mean you can't have compassion for them. I don't forgive him, but, you know, he's a human being. You have to move on. You know, it's just as simple as that. And so you find a way to move on. And having compassion for people just in general is a good way to live in life.
Well, Alice Siebold, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alice Siebold, author of The Lovely Bones, speaking to Terry Gross in 2002.